Welcome to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. I am Dr. John, the guide for your heroic journey towards greater health, success, and most importantly, happiness. And now, on with the show.
Hey, everybody. This is Dr. John with the Evolved Caveman Podcast, and I'm really excited to share this somewhat unusual podcast with you this week. It's a copy of Jory and I doing our first masterclass on relationships. It's an overview of all the skills and tools that we believe you need to know based on our experience in the field and on research of what it takes to be in a thriving, satisfying, loving relationship. It's an hour-long course. If you are interested in learning more about the monthly masterclass series, which will continue to take place February through the end of the year, please feel free to check out theultimaterelationship.com. That's theultimaterelationship.com. Because these relationships, your primary romantic relationship, is incredibly important if you want to lead a happy, thriving life. Because what I've found is that if your relationship at home is not doing well, then the rest of your life isn't going so well either. Because that suffering, that stress, that annoyance will bleed out into every other area of your life. So check out the class, check out the tools, and let's get going on building your ultimate relationship. Thanks so much. Here we go.
Welcome back to the latest episode of The Evolved Caveman. This is Dr. John, and I am really, really excited today. Before I introduce my guest, let me ask you a question. Think about this for just a moment. What if the biggest barrier to getting what you want and need in life is not that others are unwilling to give it, but that you are afraid to ask? And that's the topic for today. With me today is Wayne Baker, the author of the book, All You Have to Do Is Ask. He is the Robert P. Tomei Professor of Business Administration and Professor of Management and Organizations at the University of Michigan Ross School of Business. He's also Professor of Sociology at the University of Michigan, and he currently serves as Faculty Director for the Center for Positive Organizations. And this is a widely respected outlet of positive psychology research on the wide topic of positive pro-social firms and cultures. His teaching and research focus on social capital, social networks, generosity, positive organizational scholarship, and values. He has published numerous scholarly articles and 4 books. His management and leadership articles appear in publications such as the Harvard Business Review, Chief Executive Magazine, and Sloan Management Review. He puts his knowledge into practice as a frequent guest speaker, management consultant, and advisor and board member of Give and Take, Inc., developers of the Givitas collaborative technology platform. He's won various awards, including the Senior Faculty Research Award from the Ross School of Business and several others, which I will skip over for the sake of time. And he also went to Northwestern University and did a postdoc at Harvard, which is where my dad went to Northwestern. So Wayne, thank you so much for coming on board. How are you doing?
Well, thank you, John. I'm glad to be here.
That's an impressive bio, I got to say. I cut stuff out.
Well, maybe if you just hang around long enough, those things happen.
No, I don't think so. I think you're being too humble there. But anyway, thank you for joining us. You've done some tremendous work in your career. So let's go to the book first and about All You Have to Do Is Ask. So why should we learn to ask?
Well, it's a fundamental question. Let me trace back to the origin of this idea. So 21 years ago, Cheryl Baker and I created an activity called the Reciprocity Ring. And our intention with this activity was to enable a team or a group to build a culture of generosity, to give and get help from one another. And there's a particular recipe or series of steps that you need to take to do this. But one is that everyone has to make a request, but they spend most of their time helping other people meet their requests. You know, I've got a resource, I've got the answer, I could share it, I could tap my external network and introduce you to someone who can help. And back then, I started every session the same way, with a little lecture on the importance of helping and giving and being generous. And you know, John, what I found is that that was never the problem. People were incredibly generous. The real problem was getting people to ask, that everyone struggled with coming up with a request. And what I realized is that The key to generosity is getting people to ask. And the only way that you get the resources that you need is by asking. In fact, in the workplace, between 70 to 90% of the help that is given or the resources that are shared is in response to people making requests for them. But if people don't ask, nothing will happen and you don't get the input, the resources, the ideas that you need really to be productive.
Okay, hold on just a second, Wayne. Repeat that stat again.
So in the workplace, 70 to 90% of the help that is given is in response to requests for help.
That is incredible. And one of the reasons your book really, really resonated with me is I've struggled with asking my whole life. I mean, I talk to men daily about the fact that we are socialized not to ask for help. We are socialized to be self-reliant. We are socialized that asking for help is a sign of weakness. So in a way, we're working on this at two different ends, but it's still a similar question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you mentioned, self-reliance. That over-reliance on self-reliance is one of the roadblocks to asking for what you need. You know, self-reliance is an important value. It's a big motivator. I believe in the importance of it, but it is possible to take it too far. You know, there's a lot of times you could solve a problem more efficiently and creatively by stopping, reaching out, asking for help, input, a brainstorm session with others.
Yeah, and I think that we're definitely on the same page there. And so let's go over some of the reasons why it's so hard to ask, because you've got eight reasons and I love these. And I'm curious where our listeners will see themselves in these eight reasons.
Yeah, so the first one we mentioned, which is over-reliance on self-reliance. You got to realize you could just go too far with that particular value. Another one is that we don't ask sometimes because we're worried or concerned that people will think we're incompetent, weak, ignorant, can't do our jobs, not educated, whatever it might be. And here, the research can be really helpful for updating or correcting that belief. So the research shows that as long as you make a thoughtful request, people will think you are more competent, not less. And so that's important to realize. Mm-hmm. Another common barrier is that we often think that, you know, no one can help us. You know, invariably, when I run some of these activities and exercises, somebody will take me aside and say, you know, I'm not going to ask for what I really need because I know no one here can help me. And my answer is always the same, which is you never know what people know or who they know until you ask. So I say, just ask and we'll see what happens. And, you know, 99.9% of the time, they get incredible help on whatever it is that they ask for. So other things could be that, people don't want to appear to be selfish or they don't feel like they've earned the privilege. That's an easy one. So I say, well, then go out and help people, you know, respond, look for opportunities to help other people, to give. And then you'll feel, you know, better about asking when you have a need.
Yeah. And one of the things that was in the book was the fact that our work culture lacks psychological safety. And this one is near and dear to my heart. Google came out with that study, I don't know, a year or two ago, looking at the traits of the best performing teams at Google. And the one common trait that they found over and over was psychological safety.
Yeah, and that was an incredible and very helpful study. And that was the number one factor. There were others, of course, but that was the top of the list, which shows how important psychological safety is.
What do you attribute psychological safety to? How do you make sense of that?
Well, Amy Edmondson at Harvard has done the pioneering work on that, and she defines it as the workplace or the team or group being safe for interpersonal risk-taking, which means you can ask questions, you can ask for help, you can question authority. And a lot of the tools and practices that I write about are even more effective in a psychologically safe workplace. That just makes sense. But I've also found that in a psychologically unsafe workplace, they will start to make it safer bit by bit. And I think that's the good news, mm-hmm. is that by using some of these practices and tools, the workplace will become safer over time, and then the tools become more effective. It's kind of a virtuous cycle.
Is there such a thing as a psychologically safe workplace?
Oh, I think there is. There is the whole spectrum. So if I think about our Center for Positive Organizations with the staff and the faculty there, definitely a psychologically safe place to ask for anything or to ask a question or to admit that you're upset or with what's going on in the world right now, that you have a lot of real concerns and worries, a very safe place to do that. And there are others like that as well. I don't know that it's the norm, and certainly workplaces vary on that dimension. Yep. But again, the good news is that no matter where you are, there are ways to make it safer by using some of these practices.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me I deal with executives in a wide range of different companies, from Twilio to CrowdStrike and different places. But some of the CEOs or C-level execs that I deal with, I would say, really struggle with their own irritability. And to me, any degree of anger, irritability, annoyance, frustration, rage, anger, all those are one of the biggest barriers to creating a safe workplace, a psychologically safe workplace. What else do you see coming into it?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the leader, whether it's the leader of a team, of a unit, or the entire organization, plays a really big role in this. And so one thing that I write about is the importance of the leader being a role model of the behavior that they want. So in the context of asking for what you need, I've seen many leaders will say, if you need anything, just come to me. I'm glad to help. But they won't ask for what they need. It's if I call it the sage syndrome. It's like, I've got to be the source of all wisdom, knowledge, and information, and I have no needs myself. But if the leader's not willing to take a bit of a risk and ask for what they need, others are going to be really reluctant to do it. So I really encourage leaders to, they've got to set the stage. They've got to be a role model of the behavior that they want.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. So what do you, so I'm biased, right? I look at the world through the lens of emotion. And so I see emotions, lack of emotional literacy, lack of ability to stay in uncomfortable conversations, how you respond to others' emotions. Those to me seem to be the biggest barriers to psychological safety in the workplace. What am I missing?
Yeah, so I think emotions play a really big role in this. And here's how emotions play into this context of giving and asking for help and assistance. One is that we know, and we've done some studies, Adam Grant and I have done some studies on this, where what we found is that, of course, giving makes people feel good. Helping creates what the economists call that warm glow of giving. That's a positive emotion. But we've also found that receiving help also creates positive emotions in the receiver, and the emotion is gratitude for the help received. So both giving and getting can increase positive emotions, which would then play into a little bit psychologically safer workplace.
So, and this is tangential, but where do you fall on the argument in the research about altruism and whether or not altruism actually exists?
Yeah, so I think, I think it exists biologically, but I also think it's a learned behavior. Now, I've done some studies where we've created contexts in which people can give and get help from one another, and we've measured their underlying values, such as altruism or self-interest, and it certainly plays into it. And so what we have found, so there's four types of people that I've learned about and I write about in the book. One is called the selfish taker, so that would be the person who's low on altruism, who really has no problem asking for what they need, but they don't really help other people. What we have found is that if you put someone like that who's very self-interested or a selfish taker in a group context or that's transparent and using some of the team tools that require you to both ask and to give, they will be just as generous as anyone else.
Interesting. Because to me, and so to pull back a second, if I look at the general population in terms of mental health labels, and, roughly 15% of the population would be sociopaths, narcissists, borderline, psychopaths. And my thought sometimes is that those people I would put more into the realm of selfish takers, and the selfish takers tend to abuse our sense, the other 85% of the population, their sense of altruism, of giving, of sharing. And that, I think there's also some deceit, manipulation in there. But any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and what we've found is that the at least in the workplace, the selfish taker experiences a decline in their own productivity and performance because eventually people see what they're up to and they stop helping them. They stop responding to the requests or even demands that the selfish taker would make.
Do you see that as, and I don't know if you have any data on this, but my assumption is that, or I guess where I've seen this in the corporation is that, and I'll use the label narcissists just for ease, but someone that, you know, kind of flies into a rage, externalizes blame, manipulative, deceitful, that kind of thing, that they can, that strategy works to a point that will help them climb the ladder, that they manage up, not down. And they can climb to a level, maybe a VP level, but then where the numbers dwindle, they tend to, those techniques get exposed and then they top out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that happens. I think a related thing is who do you let into the organization in the first place? So the organizations that we have observed as thriving, positive organizations really place a premium on selection and recruitment. And so that you get very few of those people coming in the first place. And if you do, they tend not to get promoted or to advance in the organization. So that's in terms of what an organizational leader can do would be to really think about the kinds of people that you're attracting and recruiting. Are you inadvertently recruiting people who tend to be selfish takers? What you want to do is you want to recruit people who are both generous and willing to ask for what they need.
Well, and I mean, it's interesting that you say that because, and to some extent, that seems to be partly a function of what the business is itself. For example, I could see more people that are driven by value to serve others going into a medical supply company or to, you know, a biotech company that's working on, I don't know, software to help parse genes versus, I don't know, maybe a real estate development company, which it seems like the people that are attracted into that area might have a different set of values, might be less inclined to be generous and give.
Yeah, I think there is that tendency. I think the incentive system also matters a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're measuring and rewarding just individual performance, you're going to get a lot less cooperation. People are going to be less likely to help one another or to ask for what they need. So that's one of the levers that a leader can pull, which is to think about, you know, what is the recognition and incentive system that we have in place here, both formally and informally, and how can we better measure, recognize, and incentivize the behaviors that we really want? So if you want people to cooperate, you know, you need to recognize that and to reward them for that.
So I'm curious about that, how you would incentivize cooperation, giving, receiving, how would you track it, I guess is the question.
Well, you know, a lot of performance management systems already track helping. You know, that's one of the, particularly in the more positive organizations, that would be one of the competencies that would be measured. And what I think is that you need to also add the other side of it is the asking, because we know that it's the asking or the requesting that drives the whole giving-receiving cycle. And so, sure, you want to reward and recognize givers and helpers, but you also need to reward and recognize the people who are on the other side. So that's what I advocate, is that you want to measure and reward both sides.
So this is a wild one to me. So I've read about half your book, which is honestly a huge compliment to you because I'm, you know, always reading 6 to 8 books at a time. But this came out in the book also that it's the ask that drives the cycle. Tell us about that. That was wild to me.
Yeah. So the ask is the driver or the catalyst of the whole giving receiving cycle. You know, we first saw this 21 years ago when we created the reciprocity ring. They realized that, you know, let's say you've got everyone who is very willing to help, very willing to give, but if no one is asking for what they need, nothing can happen. So it turns out that the ask or the request really is the key to the entire process. And so what I set upon myself, the task was to, so over time I started thinking about, well, what other activities, what other ways could we enable individuals, teams, or entire organizations to get better at building a workplace culture of generosity where we know that we need to focus on the request? What are routines to make it easier for people to make requests? And then it will bring out the natural generosity in everyone else. So that's really what the book is about. I wrote it to be a how-to book with lots of tools and practices for individuals, teams, and organizations to think about, okay, here's how you can do it.
Yeah, and I think the book is incredibly well done, and I highly recommend it to anyone out there listening. To if you're in a corporation, you should read this. I really like the number of questions and tools that you put in the book that are actionable.
You know, in the beginning, John, I thought that motivating people would be enough.
Me too.
You know, think about the, okay, let's get past those 8 roadblocks. But what I found is that was half the battle. Mm-hmm. The other half was, okay, well, what, you know, people aren't going to reinvent the wheel. It's sort of like, well, what can I do? People kept saying, okay, well, I'm really motivated, but I still don't know what to do. Figuring out what to do turns out to be a really hard problem. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to start collecting practices and tools that work. And so I had to ask for a lot of help, you know? So I used some of our own tools to make requests for examples of how you could do this. And, you know, that's what I compiled and put into the book. But it really is the request that drives that the whole process.
Yes, Wayne, I think you might have just also hit upon one of the fundamental challenges in the field of therapy, and that is that insight itself is insufficient to affect change in behavior. That we need insight, yes, but I think more importantly, we need tools. We need the why and the how.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
We've kind of touched on this, but I also want to drive home the point. Tell us briefly about the law of giving and receiving.
Well, there is always a focus on helping and giving, and I think that's appropriate and it's very important. And people have talked about, you know, the law of giving or the law of helping. But as I was doing more research on this topic, collecting tools, interviewing a lot of people across a wide range of industries, I said, you know, really, that's half of the law. At the other side is the law of receiving, is that we have an obligation to both ask for and give help. And that's, you know, of the 4 types that I studied, you know, we already talked about the selfish taker, but the place you want to be as an individual, a team, or an organization is what I call the giver requester. The person who freely and generously gives, doesn't keep track. It's not about tit for tat exchange or any of that. And you ask for what you need when you need it. And so I found that, you know, I really think that it's a law. You have to do both sides if you really want to be productive.
And so hit the other 2 types of givers and requesters while we're there.
Yeah, so the selfish taker, there's a giver requester, which is where we want to be. A third type is what I call the lone wolf. And in some ways, that's the most tragic of the 4 types because they don't give and they don't ask. So they're working kind of disconnected in an isolated kind of way. You know, they're not engaged in what's going on around them. And their performance really suffers as a result of that. The 4th type is actually the most common one. It's the overly generous giver. And so I have an assessment in the book, and there's a free version of it available on the website for the book, anyone who would like to take it. And what we have found is that, you know, when we've had lots of people take this assessment, and when we plot this out on the 2 dimensions, so we've got giving and asking, is that, you know, a large number of people, the large majority, are in that overly generous giver category. That's the most common one.
And Wayne, share that website while we're on that point.
So it's thebooktitle.com. So all you have to do is ask.com.
Excellent.
And if you take the assessment online, it also produces a free report where you can compare yourself against the population of assessment takers, which can be very, very helpful.
That's great. And so which of these 4 types or which one or 2 did you see yourself most in when you started doing this research?
Well, you know, I was raised to be very independent, to be a self-starter, you know, and it was over time I'd realized that that wasn't the most productive way to be. So I think over the course of my life, I had to learn to be more of a giver requester. And certainly in terms of the research that I do and the tools I bring into the classroom or executive education, you know, it's very much, you know, I try to be as helpful as I can, even to people I don't know at all. And, you know, and I think very clear about what help do I need? And I'll make a request. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the acknowledgements in the book, and it's interesting, these days, the acknowledgements are in the very end of the book. In the old days, they used to be in the beginning of the book. But you'll see the first line of my acknowledgments is that I asked a lot of people for help with this book. And then there's a list of probably over 100 names of people who agreed to be interviewed or responded to a request I made. And so very much I had to practice the message of the book in order to get the material I needed to write the book.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I think for me, looking at my past, the lone wolf definitely hits home, and the overly generous giver definitely hits home. And I think that practice of learning how to ask for more of what you need, I've started doing it since reading the book. And hold on just a second, Wayne. Here's a PSA. So what I need from you listeners is I need you to rate, review, and share the podcast. Thank you very much. All right, back to the show. But yeah, I think that just having an awareness of where do you stand, what are your tendencies, is a great act of self-awareness. The other thing that kind of this brings up for me is I talk to a lot of men about, more so receiving compliments. And then, you know, how do we give compliments? But this kind of enters into this framework as well, because I see a lot of us men have a really hard time with receiving compliments. You know, we don't believe them. We think someone's blown smoke up our ass. We don't think they know us. They're not sincere, or they're trying to work us. And so, you know, one of the great practices for the men that I work with is trusting that the person giving you the compliment perhaps sees your positive traits better than you do, more clearly, and that there's an importance to actually believing those compliments as true, because it can help to increase your self-worth, your self-confidence, and your awareness of what your positive traits and skills are.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also a way of recognizing what your strengths are. So if somebody thanks you for something that you've done and say it was easy for you to do, that's because it was a strength of yours. It's a way of you know, getting data and information back on that. Yeah, and I think that a good starting assumption is that every compliment is sincere. Now, we know they're not always.
True.
But I would take that as a good starting assumption, and the best response to a compliment is an expression of gratitude.
Yeah, and I think I know for me, like when people would give me compliments, there was something like a feeling of embarrassment or discomfort, and I just wanted to get away from it for a while. So I would say something like, oh, you know, thank you, or thank you so much, or I would dismiss it kind of. So it would hit my heart and fall to the floor. And I was just looking to get out of that situation. And with practice, I've been able to say, you know, thank you so much. That really means a lot to me. I really appreciate that. And just sit with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And like if you say, oh, it was nothing. Well,
exactly.
That's actually not true, because it was really something to the other person. That's why they're appreciating and acknowledging you. And again, that's why I think the best response to that is a thank you, an expression of gratitude.
Yeah, and, which, you know, and this is, you know, kind of tangentially related, but one of the things that I was doing without any kind of awareness was people would say, thank you. And I would say, of course. And someone pointed out to me, they said, you know, when you say, of course, you're not expressing gratitude there to them for that thank you. And you know, so it might be better to just go back to, you know, a heartfelt, you're welcome.
Yeah. Or say, like, thank you. I really appreciate that.
You're right.
Yeah.
So let's move on, because part of this is, to me, where the rubber really hits the road. And I think this is where some of the more difficult work comes in, because you did mention that many of us have a hard time figuring out what the hell it is we do need. And then how do we ask? Because, I mean, I know the men that I work with, we don't feel comfortable asking. We've not been taught to ask. We're not sure we are worthy of asking. Like, we struggle with asking, and to ask itself, I would argue, is a very vulnerable act. And we don't like to be vulnerable, because it's, in a way, putting yourself out there to be rejected, even if it's on a small level of just, no, I can't help you out right now. That still has a slight emotional sting to it. So let's go into kind of how do we figure out our needs and how to ask for them.
Yeah, so earlier we talked about one of the roadblocks to asking is the concern or the worry that others will think we're incompetent or weak or ignorant. And I had mentioned that as long as you make a thoughtful request, people will think you're more competent. And so there are a couple of elements or steps to creating a thoughtful request. The first one is, well, they're all about preparation. So the first one is, what's the goal? What are you trying to accomplish? What are you trying to achieve? You want some clarity on that. Sometimes people go right into an ask and they get a resource that they end up not really needing because they weren't clear on the goal. So what's, you know, there's a project, there's an assignment. What's the goal? Once you have that in mind, then you want to think about, well, what are the resources that would be helpful or beneficial in achieving that goal or making progress on achieving that goal? And here I encourage people to think broadly. So it could be information, ideas, an opportunity, you know, financial resources, maybe emotional support, political support, a referral, a connection, the list goes on and on. But to think broadly about all the kinds of resources that actually could be helpful in achieving that goal. And then once you've got an idea of what a resource is that you need, then you want to formulate what I call a SMART request. So I use SMART here a little differently from SMART goals. So the S is for specific, and you want to make a very specific request. And the reason is that that's what really triggers people's memories of what they know and who they know. A general request won't.
Right.
In fact, the most general request I ever heard was from a an executive from the Netherlands who was in one of our executive education programs. And he said, my request is for information. And I said, and I looked at him and I said, well, could you elaborate? He goes, no, it's confidential. You know, no one could help him, right? He actually was generous. He helped other people, but you know, anything with that. So the more specific, the better. The M, now this is different than the M in SMART goals, which is measurable. And measurability is nice. That's important. But here, M is meaningful. It's the why of the request. And you know, it's interesting. That is often left out. We often assume that other people know why we're asking. Mm. Never assume that. You need to explain, why is this important? Why is this meaningful? Why are you asking? And then the A is for action. You ask for something to be done. So stating a goal is not a request. A goal is a destination. A request is an action to get a resource to help you make progress moving towards that destination. So you ask for something to be done. The R is for strategically realistic. So I encourage people to make small requests, big requests, stretch requests, as long as they're authentic and real requests. But whatever it is, it's got to be within the realm of possibility. So that's the, you know, the balance to it. And then the T is time. You have to have a deadline. And here, the more specific, the better. So if you need something by next week, you know, Friday next week, you need to state that and explain why. If you say, oh, you know, sometime in 2020, less likely to get a response to that.
That makes me rethink my PSA.
Yeah, if you, and that's interesting. Yeah, you could because, apply.
I mean, this takes practice, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a skill that I need to practice, put it that way.
Well, I think that's true for all of us. I relearn my lessons every day.
Yeah. No, and so I really appreciate the training here. Okay, so the next step then is figuring out who is it that you really need to be asking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now sometimes you know from the get-go who that is. It might be your boss or your spouse or a friend or whatever. And if that's so, then that's who you would ask. But I also encourage people to say, okay, well, there are other ways of thinking about this. A couple other methods. One I call the two-step or two-degree method, which is, you know, you may not know who to ask, but you know someone who probably does know who to ask. So I have a colleague of mine, Jeff DeGraff, here at the Ross School of Business. He runs an innovatrium. It's kind of a space for innovators and entrepreneurs and venture capitalists come together. And I was interviewing him for the book, and he said, you know, I used the two-step method 180 times in 1 year for incredible success. Wow. He said, you know, often I don't know who the expert is, but I know who to ask who would know the expert. So think about that two-step method. Another is to think about your dormant connection. So a dormant connection is a relationship you once had, but your lives have gone in different directions and haven't been in touch with that person. Now, most people would say, well, I don't know. I don't think I feel very comfortable about reactivating that connection, especially when I need to make a request. But here, the research is helpful for updating that belief. What the research shows is that most people are delighted to hear from you and very willing to help. And the great thing is that because your lives have gone in different directions, they now know things and know people that you don't. So they could be even more important sources of help. And then
that's an interesting one to me too, especially with men, because I found that many men are not very good at maintaining long-term friendships. And so we fall out of touch. You know, we get busy at work, we get busy with the family. And then, for instance, our old college friends, we kind of, you know, we haven't talked to for 5, 10, 15 years. And then we're reluctant. That story in our head is going to be like, oh, they're going to be mad at me, or they're not going to hear from me. And inevitably, every time myself or someone else actually picks up the phone and calls an old friend like that, they're like, hey, John, how's it going? It's great to hear from you. What have you been up to?
Yeah, exactly. Like when I have a student from years ago recontacts me or something like that, I'm thrilled. I'm really happy to be reconnected. And really, you know, if I can help, I will help. I'm very, you know, happy to do that. So that would be, and something like, it seems like these days you can always find somebody online. You could find them on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. So you don't even have that excuse. Well, I can't find them. You know, I don't have the person's email. Fact is, these days you can find just about anyone that you would want to.
Yeah. Then the next part is how to ask, mm-hmm. where, when. So I guess the specifics of the ask.
Yeah, the where, when, and all that. That's where you've got to be really sensitive to the person you're going to ask. There are good times and bad times to ask people. You know, if the person's going through a rough patch in their personal life, may not be the time to ask. It could be that's also think about the method of communication. Some people prefer a face-to-face meeting. Some people like to have an email in advance to think about things. Some people don't mind a text or a phone call. So you really have to be, you know, think about the other person and what is their preferred mode of communication. And then when are they available? When's the best time? Now, sometimes I can think back to years and years ago when I worked in a management consulting firm, and it was really hard to get a meeting with one of the partners. But what I found is that when he was about to leave the office, I could see through my door, which was open, I could see when he was approaching the elevator. And what I learned is that if I jumped in the elevator right then, it was a perfect time to have a conversation with him. And we would talk all the way down to the first floor. Usually we'd walk to his car and he would drive me back to the front door and I'd go back up. And I found with him, it was impossible to ever get any time with him. But that worked for him, you know?
Yeah, quite strategic.
Yeah. So, you know, I said, look, man, I got to do something here. I need a decision on this. I need this resource. I need a little bit more budget to get this done. So I got to talk to this person to make the request. But I found what worked for him, because trying to get on his agenda with his secretary would put me a month out.
So let's say, I mean, one of the situations I see with a lot of clients is, let's say they're a VP and now they're in job search mode and they've got a guy that they knew that was president at their old company, but they're reluctant to reach out. Now, if you don't know their preferred way of communicating, would you suggest like sending them an email and saying, hey, you know, would love to talk. Can we schedule a time? What's your preferred way of communicating? You know, email, text, phone, Zoom, you know, something like that.
I'd say that'd be part of it. You also need to give some inclination of why you're doing it. Cause otherwise, mm-hmm. can you imagine receiving that? You're going, okay, what's up here? Right. Mm-hmm. What does this person want?
So I'd like to talk to you about an introduction at Cisco.
Yeah. Like, you know, I just got laid off and, you know, I'm looking for this and, you know, and thought, you know, that it would be helpful to talk with you and, you know, what would be a good time and way to talk? You know, something that you want to be a little bit more open about the reason, because otherwise people might get kind of suspicious.
Okay. And one of the other things you bring up is, so in that message, I don't want to start with, I am so sorry to be wasting your time, but ... So right. Not starting with the apology.
Don't start with the apology. There's no need to apologize. But you want to be, you know, you want to be polite and courteous. To the point, you know, authentic, genuine. You know, if you're explaining the M, the meaningful, the why of it, that's going to go a long way. But the apology part should never appear.
Yeah. And I see not a lot of men, but a fair percentage of men that apologize when there's no need to be apologizing. They're over apologizers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a habit that you need to get out of.
Right. And so then what about circling back around to finish the loop?
Let me mention one other way that you can ask, and that is to crowdsource. Sometimes you don't know who to ask, and you don't know who to ask who might know who to ask. And you can't think of a dormant connection to ask, but you're not stuck. So these days you can ask in a LinkedIn group. We've created a platform called Givitas, kind of a combination of giving and civitas for community, in which you can be part of a large network. And when you make a request, it's visible to the entire group. And that way, I mean, there's a lot of help that's out there. In fact, we've got a number of these Givitas communities that are, we've opened them up. They're free groups. If anyone in the, in the audience would like to join, we've got five or six of them that you can freely join.
The URL for that is?
If you go to so we have a little spinoff company called Give and Take Inc. So if you go to giveandtakeinc.com, you can find the free Givitas communities there.
Okay. And I got to tell you, there was a really, interesting synchronicity when I got in touch with you initially, because a week prior to being introduced to you, I'd been exposed to Givitas for the first time. And I was like, that's an interesting experiment. And I went and signed up for it and checked it out. And then someone introduced me to you and they're like, oh yeah, he sits on the board of Givitas. I was like, what? Like, that's weird timing.
Yeah. Small world.
Yeah. Okay. So the next step then is circling back around, I take it.
Yeah. So it's important to, follow up and let the person know what happened. And it could be that, you followed the person's recommendation. It worked out. It didn't work out, but you need to go back and re-express your gratitude for the help that was given and let that person know the outcome. So that's closing the circle. I think that's a very important part of it. A lot of times I've heard about people who really went out of the way to help someone and then they never heard what happened. Mm. They're left with, I just kind of like to know what would happen. And they're not even looking for the thank you. They just want to know. They want to close the loop. So it's important to do that as well.
And then, and I think this is a big one for men in particular, maybe people in general, but what happens if someone says, no, sorry, I can't help you?
Well, sometimes you do get a no, you get a rejection. And I always view a no as information. It's an opinion. And it could be information about the person's having a bad day. It was just an awful time to ask that person or something else is going on. Sometimes the person wishes they could help, but they weren't able to for that particular time. So sometimes coming back with a polite why could be very, very informative, which is, okay, that's fine, I understand, but can you explain why, which might help me to be better, formulating a better request down the road? And oftentimes the why is not what you expected at all. Mm-hmm. There's some other reason why they weren't able to help. And most people feel bad when they can't help. Another part of the no is that if somebody said no and you didn't know why, you'd be very reluctant to go to that back to that person again. Here, the research is helpful because the research says that a person who says no the first time is actually more likely to say yes the second time because they feel bad about saying a no the first time.
Yeah, and I think that one of the takeaways from that is to work to take rejection less personally. There was a TED talk about that, a guy that did like 100 days of random asks, and he would do the same thing. He would ask why afterwards if he got rejection, and he said, the answer almost always blew me away. So one of his random asks was, he just went to a random house with a potted plant, knocked on the door and said, hey, can I plant this plant in your backyard? And they didn't know the guy, and the lady was like, no. And he said, well, how come? And she said, well, I've got a dog and the dog would, dig up the plant immediately. And she said, but if you go across the street to that person right there, they love plants and I'm sure they would say yes.
Yeah, that's a great example. Like you never would have thought of that as being the reason, right? Mm-hmm. And
not I don't know you, not get out of my house, not your security risk.
Yeah, that's right.
It's my dog.
That's right.
I think in general, learning to accept rejection gracefully and taking it less personally is a huge life lesson. And then you talk about being grateful and direct and authentic as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's important that, you want to do it in an open, transparent, authentic way. And so, take a no as information.
We only have 10 minutes. So I apologize for rushing forward, but I told you at the beginning of the show before we were talking that, I am a values geek. I am a geek about ethics and morality. And you've written books about values. So how do you, you know, when I look at your list here of determining your goals, articulating the goals, your vision, and so on that we just went through, to me, and my mind automatically puts values at number zero of that list before determine your goals.
Yeah, so I think values are very important. It definitely plays into this. We talked earlier about sometimes people can't figure out what their goals are or for whatever that reason. But if you're clear on what your moral principles are, that can be, you know, principles are guiding lights. It's part of our moral compass. And, you know, I think that it's, you know, having a value of helping and generosity is important and say, well, if that's a value of mine, I need to look for people who need help and to help them. And these days with COVID-19, there are a lot of people who need help of all kinds, mm-hmm. you know, and it's, look for ways of doing that, if it's doing it online or whatever. But there's also a value of, you know, of providing for oneself, taking care of oneself and one family, one's mm-hmm. family, community, and friends, you know, and that often means making requests on behalf of not just you, but the people that you care for, that you are responsible for, that you need to look out for. And so that could be a motivation for making requests as well.
And, you know, before we started recording, I was telling you that when I was doing my doctorate at Cal, I was a big fan of Lawrence Kohlberg's theory of moral development. You know, there's these five discrete stages of moral thinking that we go through, and it was very neat and tidy. And I was like, oh my God, this is it. This is amazing. And then my advisor said, well, this doesn't predict moral action very well at all, which led me down a different path. And you were saying that values actually now have been shown to predict action much better. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, one of the keys is how we ask about people's values. And it's because depending on how we ask engages different thought processes. So if I ask you to, you know, describe your values and give illustrations of it, so you're doing it in a very thoughtful way, that's engaging one way of thinking. And oftentimes people will present things that they think they ought to be saying, or a justification or a rationalization. It may only be loosely related, if at all, to their behavior. So what we've learned is that if you have people respond to very short declarative sentences without much thought, just go through, answer it without a lot of thought, that gets closer to representing people's true values, and measuring values that way is more closely related to behavior. I give you one example. If you ask people how patriotic they are, you know, people can answer that on a scale of, you know, very patriotic, not patriotic, or whatever mm-hmm. it is. And some economists have shown that people who are very patriotic tend to hold more stock in domestic companies than they rationally ought to. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, and they also buy American-made cars, I imagine.
Yeah, you're more likely to buy American, to invest in stock in American companies, even though if your goal was to maximize your return, mm-hmm. diversify your portfolio more.
So, yeah, I mean, so how do you see values as entering into this whole equation of identifying your goals and that? Because it seems to me that's the precursor, however.
Yeah, so if if your goals... You could think about values as being kind of the underlying substrate that help you figure out what some of your goals are. If you value a community, then you think about, well, if I value community, that's a strong guiding principle for me. Well, what does that mean in terms of goals for me and my community, and then resources, and they can go down the sequence that we already talked about. So I think it is helpful to think about what one's strengths are, because those are the ways that you can really help other people, to have some clarity on what your underlying values are that help you can figure out, again, values I think are a source of strength, help you figure out what some of your goals are, and then to do some of the exercises to help you figure out what your goals are. I think you can never go too far in self-assessment and self-insight.
Mm-hmm. Is there a values assessment that I can get access to? That you were talking about these short declarative statements. Are those what people are writing themselves, or do you have sort of declarative statements on specific values written out ahead of time?
Yes. So there's a couple of online resources that have been developed by other people that are really very effective at that. One is called the VIA Character Strengths.
Oh, yeah.
And if you just look up VIA,
yeah,
you would find it that way. And they have a huge global database. And so that could be very insightful too for the comparisons you make.
But that, and so I've used that and I've used it with clients, but what then is the difference between strengths and values?
Well, values is a type of strengths. So I teach about the strengths perspective to all of my MBA students. Mm-hmm. And I say, okay, you know, I always say, look, I want you to think broadly about strengths. So it could be your core competencies. It could be a natural born talent. It could be a particular skill that you have, but it also could be aspects of your identity. Say your demographic background, your gender, whatever. And you can think about what are your guiding principles in life or your values. Those are a source of strength too. So it's a, you know, you got to think about strengths broadly. Values or guiding principles are a part of it.
Yeah, because I could see having a strength, you know, being strong at something, having a competency for it, but it not being overly connected to your deepest held values. And so it would be used less frequently.
Yeah, or if you use it, it'd be much less satisfying for you.
Right. Sorry, there was somewhere else I was going to go with the values. I lost it. So how do you connect what you're doing with asking and receiving with values? I mean, do you see those two as overlapping?
I think it does. So when I've worked with various groups and they want to, I said, okay, we value collaboration. We value cooperation. It's okay, well, what are the behaviors that create that? And that's when you get into the idea of asking and giving. You know, at the core of a workplace culture of generosity or collaboration, it's people freely asking for what they need and generously helping one another. So I like to get down to, you've got that value, say, well, what are the behaviors that are going to help you to realize or to live that value? If the value is collaboration and cooperation, then you've got to be talking about asking for and giving help.
Okay. So I remember what I was going to ask about values. One of the things that I used to do with clients is have them come up with their top five most deeply held values. And over time, I've condensed that to two. Because I think that when we're in, and I'm usually using values in situations where the emotional mind is about to hijack the rational thinking mind. So, you know, you got a third of a second and you can lengthen that with practice and awareness. But I'm trying to allow or teach clients to access one of their top two values, like when anger is overcoming them. So if family is one of your top values, is screaming at your daughter going to be in the service of your value of family? Do you have any thoughts on, you know, best practices for the number of values that people should identify?
Yeah. So let's take anger. So I learned this from Paul Saginaw, who is one of the co-founders of Zingerman's Community of Businesses, a positive organization here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And he has a saying, he says, when you get furious, get curious.
Like it.
And the idea is that it's okay, well, why am I getting so pissed off right now? Why am I getting angry here? You know, what is really bugging me here about this? What, you know, what am I bringing to us? You know, because when you're angry, you know, you're part of it. You know, it's not just about the other person, it's about you too, because you're reacting to something. And if you get curious about your anger and reflect on that, it can be really insightful.
Well, and I think, I mean, that's one of the tools, and I don't know if I'd classify it as a value or a strength, but curiosity is so incredibly powerful that if you can approach situations or feedback or rejection with curiosity and non-judgment, it helps a tremendous bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you take a part of that would be to have a learning orientation.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, Wayne, this has been a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate you coming on board. So tell me where people can get a hold of you or get a hold of the book or
any links that you want to share with us.
Well, thank you, John. This has been a pleasure and a very enjoyable conversation. So you could find me on LinkedIn very easily, Wayne Baker. But you can get all my contact information, that free assessment, other free resources, learn more about the book at the website for the book, which is allyouhavetodoisask.com. And I wanted to provide a lot of things that people would find useful, whether they get the book or not. So we even have a learning map that you can freely download. And I encourage people to share that with others.
Fantastic. And all that will be in the show notes as well, so you can access it there. And Wayne, I just want to say thank you for the important work you're doing. Please keep up the outstanding work.
Well, John, the same for you. And thank you for this opportunity.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And that is it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.